Welcome back to the program. In their new book about the state of America today, Tom Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum talk about the end of the Cold War as perhaps the seminal event that reshaped America. Suddenly, without an enemy, we had to redefine who we are and what we represented as a nation. Yet as important as that event was, we know little about what went on in the former Soviet Union that precipitated the end of the Cold War and the real impact inside Russia, an impact that shapes events there even today. We're going to talk about this with my guest, Connor O'Cleary. He lived and worked in Russia during the final years of the Soviet Union as the Moscow correspondent for the Irish Times. He's won numerous journalism awards, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here today to talk about his book, Moscow, December 25th, 1991, the last day of the Soviet Union. Connor O'Cleary, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Great to have you here. Talk a little bit first about what this day, December 25th, 1991, actually represented, and really the handover of power from Gorbachev to Yeltsin, and what was involved in that.
Well, this was the day that the red flag came down from the Kremlin. The Soviet Union, which was composed of 15 republics, dissolved into 15 independent countries, Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the president of the Soviet Union, found himself without a job. He had to hand over power to the Russian president, Boris Yeltsin, and that involved handing over the Kremlin and handing over the nuclear suitcase. And on that day, when he transferred the nuclear suitcase to Boris Yeltsin, that meant that the Soviet Union ceased to exist as a superpower. So this day is absolutely one of the most crucial days of the last century, because it represented the end of the Cold War, the end of one of the two ideologies, the fascism and communism, that fought the Second World War. And it represented the end of the conflict, the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Of course, this battle that had gone on between Gorbachev and Yeltsin had been brewing for quite some time. We all remember perhaps the coup that took place in August of that year, but this had been a battle that had been going on since really Gorbachev began perestroika.
Absolutely right. When Gorbachev began his reforms, he put a new team around him. This was around 1985, and one of his new team was Boris Yeltsin. But they very soon fell out. Yeltsin complained loudly and bitterly behind the scenes that the reforms weren't going quickly enough. And their two personalities rubbed up against each other. And eventually Gorbachev fired Yeltsin. But he fired him in a very ruthless way. He had him brought before a party committee and humiliated. And Yeltsin never forgave him for it. And that formed the background for the interaction between these two men. And indeed, one might say that from the last couple of years, Yeltsin was working to break up the Soviet Union so that he could simply get rid of Gorbachev.
You mentioned that the abuse that Gorbachev had heaped upon Yeltsin was so intense it almost drove Yeltsin to suicide at one point.
Well, absolutely. Yeltsin was so depressed after his treatment at the hands of Gorbachev and his comrades in the Central Committee that he says in his memoirs he tried to commit suicide by cutting his chest open with a pair of scissors. Mikhail Gorbachev thinks that he was faking, but there was a second meeting where Gorbachev hauled Yeltsin out of his hospital bed to face another committee of Communist Party members, the Moscow Committee, and that was a very, very traumatic day for Yeltsin, and he had to be brought back to his hospital bed, and he claims in his memoirs that this was one of the most ruthless and cruel things that Gorbachev could have done to him.
This notion that, in fact, Yeltsin wanted to break up the nation as a way to get back at Gorbachev, how much truth is there to that?
I think there's an element of truth in that. I think the dynamic of history was such that the Soviet Union was coming to its end. The way it came to its end, though, on that last day, December 25th, 1991, was very much shaped by the enmity between the two men. Just 3 weeks beforehand, Yeltsin and the heads of two other powerful republics in the Soviet Union met almost secretly in a dacha in a forest near the Polish border, and they agreed to collapse the Soviet Union. And one of the elements in their thinking was this was one way to get Gorbachev out of the Kremlin, because Mikhail Gorbachev was trying desperately to keep the Soviet Union together in a revised form so that he could continue to be president of an entity which would still be a superpower, because he wanted to continue controlling nuclear weapons and foreign policy. But Yeltsin and his other Republican leaders were having none of it. And Gorbachev only came to realize in the last few days, before December 25th, that the game was up and that he couldn't hold on any longer.
One of the particularly interesting things is that the rest of the world, including many of the European leaders, Margaret Thatcher and Helmut Kohl and others, really wanted Gorbachev to stay.
Well, that group includes President H.W. Bush of the United States. He was very fond of Gorbachev. They had a very friendly relationship. He trusted Gorbachev, and he thought that the world would be a better place if the Soviet Union continued to exist with Gorbachev at its helm in a role that would be friendly towards the United States. And I think there were people in the Bush administration who were very concerned that if the Soviet Union broke up into 15 republics, some of which had nuclear weapons, that this would destabilize the world. As it turned out, Yeltsin and the other republic leaders agreed 3 days before the last day that they would transfer all the nuclear weapons to Russia. And Yeltsin took great pains to reassure the West that this was going to be a responsible leadership. And as it turned out, the Soviet Union collapsed without a shot being fired, and all the republics went off and became independent countries without waging any wars among themselves.
What's particularly interesting is kind of the class battle that seemed to be going on inside the former Soviet Union, that the democratic forces, the forces of democracy, had been at play for some time, and certainly Gorbachev's move towards perestroika reflected that. But clearly, as you write about it, they were two very, very competing forces. They were kind of the elitist democratic forces that Gorbachev represented, and kind of the masses and the military that Yeltsin represented.
Well, that's a very interesting point. Gorbachev attracted to himself the intelligentsia, the pro-democracy forces, at the beginning of his perestroika. But he lost a lot of them at the beginning of 1991 when the Kremlin began a crackdown in the Baltics. At that point, a lot of the pro-democracy elements in the Soviet Union turned to Yeltsin. And the reason they turned to Yeltsin was because Yeltsin was a man of the people who could get mass support and support from the army, where the intelligentsia couldn't do that on their own. So there was an alliance between Boris Yeltsin and the intelligentsia to bring full democracy to what was the Soviet Union.
One of the things that contributed to this kind of elitist view of Gorbachev really was his wife, Raisa. Talk about that.
Well, Raisa is a very remarkable woman. She was a committed Marxist, but she was very much behind Mikhail Gorbachev in his attempts to reform the Soviet Union and make it a better place so it could properly feed and clothe its citizens. Raisa, however, in the last few months of the Soviet Union, underwent a traumatic experience during the attempted coup in August of 1991. She had a stroke, and she was quite ill at the time that the Soviet Union collapsed. She was remarkable in that she was the first wife of a Soviet leader to appear in public and to travel around the world with her husband and to present to the world a normal couple, whereas before, Soviet leaders had tended to be rather grim gentlemen who went around the world just saying yet, and that their wives didn't have any role beside them.
Even before the interpersonal battles really heated up between Yeltsin and Gorbachev, there was an underlying issue in that Yeltsin believed that the reforms that Gorbachev was putting in place simply weren't taking place fast enough.
Yes, absolutely right. This came to a climax at the end of 1990 when Yeltsin and Gorbachev, despite their differences, decided, right, let's get together and try and sort this out and let's move to a market economy. They set up a small group of economists, radical economists, who decided the only thing to do was to leave communism behind and go to the market. Gorbachev agreed with that, but he came under huge pressure from sections of Soviet society, the military and the industrial complex, who would lose their subsidies and lose their power. And he decided on a fudge. He was a bit of a social engineer, Mikhail Gorbachev. And this fudge was the worst of every world. It was neither going towards the market economy properly or maintaining the Soviet system. And that enraged Yeltsin and disillusioned the reformers in the Soviet Union and gave them all the more reason to side with Yeltsin in the last few months of the USSR.
Where was the military in all of this?
Well, interestingly, the military at the beginning of Gorbachev's time, Gorbachev was 6 years in power, was a very, very powerful force. It occupied most of Eastern Europe, and it was the military arm of a superpower. But when Gorbachev started his reforms, the whole of the Soviet Union became a talking shop, and the military became a debating society, so that by the time the hardliners around Gorbachev attempted a coup in August of 1991, the military was divided. Some of them supported Yeltsin and thought that he was heading the country in the right direction. Some supported Gorbachev. Some were for going back to the Stalinist past. So the coup failed simply because the military was divided. At the same time, and this is something I turned up in my research, in the dying days of the Soviet Union, there were all sorts of rumors around Moscow of hardliners in the military trying to attempt a coup. And in fact, at one stage, the fortifications were put around the Kremlin in December of that year. And at another point, Yeltsin feared he was going to be arrested if Gorbachev decided to ask the military to stage a coup. But by then, it was too late. The military was having none of it. They realized that history was moving on, and they were very demoralized by having to withdraw from Eastern Europe. So they sat on the sidelines.
Why was Yeltsin so successful in getting the leaders of the various republics on his side?
One of the reasons, actually, was a very human reason. A lot of them disliked Gorbachev. Another reason was the hardliners in the republics, the Communist Party chiefs who had ruled those fiefdoms, if you like, under the thumb of the Kremlin, they saw that the Soviet Union was heading towards a breakup, and they realized that the only way for them to continue in power was to become nationalists themselves. And they saw Yeltsin as the biggest nationalist of all. He wanted to take Russia out of the Soviet Union. So they all saw Yeltsin as the person that they should relate with rather than Gorbachev. It wasn't the case with one of the most powerful Republic leaders, Nazarbayev of Uzbekistan, but he eventually towed the line and sided with Yeltsin and said, right, we're all going to become independent, we're all now nationalists, and let's get on with it.
All of this, of course, was against the backdrop of a country that was, from an economic perspective, crumbling from the inside.
Absolutely. I recall being in Moscow in 1991, the queues in the shops were long and very fractious. Moscow radio told people, don't look for food, look for a queue and count yourself lucky if you find one and join it. This was a time of great deprivation in the Soviet Union. Western European countries were flying in flour and other basic goods. The United States was, at the time of of the fall of the Soviet Union, conducting a mini Marshall Plan, flying in aid to airports around the Soviet Union. There wasn't enough petrol for the airports. The airports were all closed. Domestic flights were cancelled. The country was in a wretched state. And one of my favorite anecdotes, actually, from that time is when Boris Yeltsin met John Major, who was Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And John Major asked him to describe the state of Russia in one word. And Yeltsin said, good. And Major was taken aback. He said, well, how do you describe it in two words? And he said, not good. And it certainly was not good.
To what extent did the West play a role in that? There's an awful lot of apocryphal versions of this story whereby the Reagan administration played a role in the economic decay of the Soviet Union.
Well, I'm firmly of the belief that the Star Wars helped bring about the end of the Soviet Union because the amount of investment involved for the Soviet Union to compete in the superpower competition was too much. They just couldn't cope. The military in the former Soviet Union got up to 25% of the national budget. This couldn't continue. And when Reagan upped the ante, that put more pressure on Gorbachev. But at the same time, I think the Soviet Union was heading towards its end, sell-by date, if you like, because even without the arms race, communism was not working. People in Russia were becoming aware that the world was passing them by. They were losing out on technology. They were losing out on consumer goods. They were losing out on quality of life. They were losing out on every level. So, yes, Reagan, with the Star Wars, did put enormous pressure on the Soviet Union, on the leadership. But I think history was on the move in that the Soviet Union was going to come to its end in the coming years. But nobody could say it at the time. We all thought this was a very powerful, stable entity. But when it came under pressure, and the pressure came from Gorbachev's reforms, because that allowed people to sit up and say what's going on here without any fear of being imprisoned or sent to the gulag. And that I think, was more important than the military pressure.
What role did the amount of resources that were being drained off towards Afghanistan, what role did that play?
Well, when Gorbachev came to power in 1985, he saw, and his comrades around him saw, that this was a war that was going nowhere, that they had to get out. It was sapping the morale of the Soviet military because they were taking a lot of casualties. And there were stirrings of unrest among the population whose sons were being forced to go off to Afghanistan, and they were coming back in boxes. So from the beginning, Gorbachev was trying to get out. Obviously, it was a financial drain, but it was also affecting the morale of the people. And in a way, I suppose it contributed also to the debate that arose in the late 1980s and brought about the end of the Soviet Union.
What role, if any, did Vladimir Putin, who would become the head of the KGB, and what role did he play in any of this?
Actually, it's quite interesting. Today, Vladimir Putin calls the collapse of the Soviet Union a great disaster, one of the great disasters of the last century. But at the same time, he opposed the coup. He was at the side of the mayor of Moscow, a man called Sobchak, in August of 1991, when the hardliners tried to take over, and he was very instrumental in opposing the hardliners in Leningrad. He also, and this is a revealing little anecdote, he was working in the mayor's office at that time. He was a KGB officer, still in the KGB, but he was working in the mayor's office as his international affairs assistant. And he saw, after the 25th of December 1991, when the red flag came down all over Russia, he saw that the Communist Party in a building across the road had refused to take the red flag down. So he sent a group of people over to haul it down. It was put up again the next day. He repeated this. He sent people over to haul it down. And when they persisted, he sent a group over with an acetylene torch to cut down the metal flagpole. So he was very much a Yeltsinite at that time. But now, looking back, he is one of the people who's nostalgic for the Soviet Union. And he has, I think, identified a feeling among the people that in Soviet times, at least, there was peace among the nationalities. Their airports weren't being bombed by the terrorists, there was a lack of all sorts of things, but at least everybody was treated equally. There was universal education. And they see the good things. They see the Soviet Union now through rosy-tinted glasses, rose-tinted glasses, I'm sorry. And he has brought back some of the elements of the Soviet Union, one of them being that the Kremlin doesn't tolerate opposition political parties, another being you cannot demonstrate in the streets. Now, in Gorbachev time, you could. You don't have free, the parties don't have free access to television. So Russia has slipped back a bit to authoritarianism, But this is, I think, because Putin identified something that happened after the Soviet Union collapsed, and that was people were a bit nostalgic for the past. They were a bit of, humiliated by the fact they'd lost their superpower status, and the country was in an economic mess, so Putin's actions have been to stabilize that.
Beyond the nostalgia for that time, there was also a sense, something perhaps in the character of the country and the character of the people, that didn't cope well with the chaos that followed December 25th, 1991.
Yes, there was absolute chaos, and in fact, within 2 years, there was a rebellion against Yeltsin, which ended up with him getting the military to shell the Russian White House, which was the seat of the Russian Parliament, and that was followed by elections and a referendum which gave more power to the president. I think there was a desire among Russians at that time to have a firm hand at the top so that the country could be stabilized again. But I've seen the Russians in the last days of the Soviet Union, and they really want democracy. There was no doubt that there was a great urge for democratic reform. I think the Democrats in Russia now have been silenced because of the chaos that followed the independence of Russia, and we're now going through a period where stability is probably uppermost in the minds of most people, and Putin is still quite popular.
How might perestroika have played out had Gorbachev stayed in power?
Well, there was an attempt involving both Yeltsin and Gorbachev and other public leaders to create a new Soviet Union in the months preceding the coup of August 1991. And in fact, the coup took place against the background of an agreement between Gorbachev and Yeltsin and the other republic leaders to actually set up a new Soviet Union where the republics would have greater independence, but you would still have a center. You would still have Gorbachev in the Kremlin controlling defense and foreign affairs and other matters. The flaw in this, though, was that the republics refused to allow the Kremlin to continue taxing them. And without taxation, you cannot have kind of any power at all. And that was the flaw in this union treaty that they were trying to negotiate. I think that it's very unlikely that that would have succeeded. So I think Gorbachev's reforms were inevitably going to bring about the breakup of the Soviet Union because the republic saw that the army wasn't going to be sent against them to maintain this entity, and the dynamic of the time was such that they could become independent.
Yeltsin has published his memoirs. What do we know about this from the point of view of Gorbachev?
Yeltsin's memoirs are full of bile against Gorbachev, and Gorbachev's memoirs are full of bitterness against Yeltsin. And in fact, after December 25th, 1991, they never met again, and they continued their quarrel until Yeltsin died some years ago.
Talk a little bit about how this day is perceived now in Soviet in Russia.
Well, you know, this is a day that people of my generation certainly remember. The red flag came down, Gorbachev resigned, but this day is not at all commemorated in Russia. Part of the reason, I think, is that there's an embarrassment about just what went on in those last few months. Embarrassment at the idea that they had lost the Cold War. And interestingly, within a few months, President George H.W. Bush was claiming to have won the Cold War. So this is something that they don't like to remember. Also, Gorbachev was never very popular in independent Russia. He stood for election in 1996, and he only got 2% of the vote. Yeltsin was perceived to be a bit of a loose cannon, somebody who drank too much, and brought shame on the country with his behavior abroad. So there's no desire to commemorate these two people as great national heroes, that we see Gorbachev in the West as a great statesman, and indeed he was. So the day that's commemorated now is the day that the Russian parliament declared sovereignty in 1990, I think it was. And for a long time, it was, I forget the date, I think it's in June. And they for a long time, it was called Independence Day. But Vladimir Putin has changed that to Russia Day because he thinks the word independence is too much and leaning towards the idea that Russia was right to leave the Soviet Union.
Conor O'Cleary, his book is Moscow, December 25th, 1991, the last day of the Soviet Union. Conor, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been a pleasure, Jeff.
Thank you.